feed them back and make sure it's understood them properly and there was no noise in your transmission, all that kind of thing. When you are satisfied, the computer does in fact understand how to dig a hole. You send it a final command, which is just called go, and it goes, and it starts going through the command. Well, fine, but suppose it runs into something that it wasn't prepared for. For example, in this first attempt to dig, they, at the end of the sequence, when they withdrew the scoop back into the housing, a little pin, which was supposed to, a protective pin, well, it was a pin that held on a protective covering, which was supposed to have fallen off, in fact did not. And the reason for that was a human error this time, it was a computer programming error. And so the tool pin hadn't fallen off, so that was no big thing, except that when the scoop was being withdrawn back into its protective housing, the pin began to stick against the housing. Well, if the computer had kept withdrawing the scoop, then that pin probably would have jammed permanently, and in fact it would have been the end of the world, because this is the only surface sample you've got, and they could have taken no more samples from that point on. So, the computer was programmed so that if it ran into anything at all like that, that it wasn't ready for, it was to stop at that point and scream to Earth, in effect, hey, something's going on that I don't understand, tell me what to do. And it just sat there and didn't do a thing until it got instructions. Well, the instructions, when it was figured out what happened, were very, very simple. Shake the pin off and then retract back into the housing. The problem is that it took the engineers about a week to find out what it was that had gone wrong and to verify that in fact it was that and not something more serious, but it caused the computer no-go, and then to send up the appropriate commands. So you lose time with this kind of thing, but you don't lose the spacecraft, and you're not in any danger of losing a spacecraft. So this happened a number of times, that some minor thing would go wrong, the computer wasn't ready for, and it did exactly what it was designed for. It stopped at that point, and I think it was very, very unfair to report those as failures. They were not. They would have been if the computer had not been designed the way it was. So far, of all of the things that have gone wrong on the four Viking spacecraft, and obviously with machines as complex as this that are doing things in an unknown environment, so very, very far away that nobody's ever studied before, it was the loss of the seismometer in Viking Lander 1. And I'm not trying to minimize that failure, but it was the only one. Of course, we now have a working seismometer on Lander 2. That's not enough. You really need both of them for maximum benefit from your data. But I repeat, that has been the only failure so far. It's been a gloriously successful mission. I think the people who designed it, and above all the people who built it, and the people who are flying it, can be very, very proud of what they have done. And I really get kind of annoyed when only the things that go wrong are reported. And so you get the idea there are all a bunch of turkeys out there, and why are we throwing away this money? That is not at all the way it goes. Here's a color image, more or less the same thing as we just put in as a pretty picture. There are the two trenches you just saw dug was the third one, and here is the surface sampler almost retreated all the way back into its housing. This is a device which cleans the magnets that are on the magnets that are on the surface sampler. I told you last week how they use everything on Viking, literally including the squeal, and this is a good example of that kind of thing. As long as you're going to be sticking something into the dirt all the time anyway, put a couple of magnets on it, doesn't cost you anything more, and see if anything sticks to them. Photograph them every once in a while, and then you found, essentially free of charge, whether there are magnetic particles in the Martian soil. And as a matter of fact, it turned out that there were. That magnetic properties experiment is by far the cheapest of the 13 experiments that make up Viking. It costs a grand total of $50 for the magnets, and there are six of them altogether. There are two there, and there are also some on the body of the spacecraft to see if anything, any magnetic materials get blown into them. And that cost is exactly one millionth of the biology experiment. And well, I'll show you in a few minutes some of the things that we did find out from that. I should have oriented you, where are we here? Well, that's the house on the hill right up there, so this is the rest of that crater that you saw before, and there's one of the bedrock outcrops. Oh yeah, and there is the Midas Muffler, sure. Okay, this is the X-ray fluorescence experiment, which is the one that studies what the soil is made of, and probably the least publicized of the three that study soil. And so I'll talk about that tonight, and I'll talk about the other two, namely the biology package and the gas chromatograph mass spectrometer, in the last two lectures when I talk about the biology findings. The X-ray fluorescence experiment, I'm not going to try to explain to you how it operates, it's just up there so you have something to look for, so it's something to look at. It shows what the soil is made of, and it is very, very sensitive about that kind of thing, and so we can learn quite a lot from it, and here's what we've learned. First of all, we've learned that it's easy to study soil, it's hard to study rocks. They studied the soil, and they found out very quickly that the soil was highly weathered material. Weathered is a general term used in geology when geologists don't want to be too specific about what they're talking about. They want to be vague and broad and general. And weathering refers to any process, physical or chemical, which changes either what rock material is made of or breaks it down physically or both. And so if you take some rock and you break it up and dissolve away some of the minerals and carry the others away and deposit them in the sand, why, there's a good extreme example of weathering on Earth. And if you simply rust the outer surface of a rock a little, that's a less extreme example of weathering, and so forth and so on. It turns out that the soil at both landing sites is made of weathering products of basaltic rock. And that should not surprise you because the major bedrock underneath the soil layer at both the landing sites is basaltic rock, as I've already told you. As a matter of fact, that's a little bit more surprising than you might think, and I'll come back to why. But after they studied what the soil was made of, and then said, well, that's very interesting. Now let's get some of the rocks, which are not as weathered. We can't take a big rock. You can't take something the size of your fist, for example, and dump it into that funnel. It won't go. But it will take things up to about the size of pebbles. And Leonard Clark, who was the chief engineer on the surface sampler team, came up with a very clever idea of how to collect pebbles. This had not been thought of before the mission. But the surface sampler has on its bottom a sieve. And the idea of that is it goes down into the soil and it brings up a bunch of gravel, and the biology experiment cannot take pebbles, and so you have got to have only fine material in it. And so if you've ever seen a movie of the Viking lander in action, it's really quite a thing to see. This sieve, the scoop, goes down this sort of jerky, nervous motion and picks up the soil and eventually comes up like so, and then it slowly, windingly gets retracted back towards the spacecraft, and then it moves over, turns itself upside down above one of the funnels, and goes as the solenoid-operated motor shakes the soil out through the sieve. Well, what Clark came up with the idea of doing was doing that over the open ground, and then, when you had nothing but pebbles left, instead of throwing them away the way they'd been doing, dumping the pebbles into the XRFE. Well, that was a very clever idea. The problem was that they had tried it 3 times so far, and they haven't gotten anything any of the 3 times they tried it. And it is beginning to look as though, in fact, there are no pebbles in the Martian soil. And you say, well, now, wait a minute. What were all those things we saw lying around in that very first picture you showed us, which certainly looked like pebbles? And that, of course, is the question. One possibility is that the things that look like pebbles are, in fact, simply clumps of soil, which are cemented together either by the dura crust that I've already told you about, or they're simply sticking together by electrostatic attraction, in the same way as the dust rolls that develop under your bed if you're not a careful housekeeper will stick together, and, you know, they're reasonably well held together. That kind of thing happens especially well in an environment where there is no humidity, and on Mars there is practically no humidity. The extreme of that is where the humidity is, you'll carry away electrostatic charges. That's why you get shocked when you shuffle across the rug and touch a doorknob in the winter, but not in summer. And the extreme of that is on the moon, where there's no humidity because there's no air. And the astronauts in the earlier missions, especially before they learned how to get around this problem, were constantly picking up what they thought was a rock, only to have it fall apart in their hands. It was actually a clod of soil. And the lunar soil is, in fact, quite cohesive. Well, it's possible that's what we've got on Mars. It's also possible that pebbles are just relatively rare, and so they're going to undergo some heroic attempts on the latter part of January and the beginning of February to deliver pebbles to the X-ray fluorescence experiment. For the time being, however, that has not succeeded. They got what they thought was a rock sample from Lander 1, but it looks in retrospect as though, in fact, what they had was simply a chunk or two of the dura crust, and therefore you say, well, great, at least they'll find out what the duracrust is made of. Unfortunately, it's not quite obvious what the duracrust is made of. Apparently, whatever the stuff is, there isn't very much of it there, and so when you analyze it, what you got was mostly the same old soil. Well, the interesting finding was that it was not only weathering products of basaltic rock, but that it was the same weathering product at both landing sites. And I told you last week why the two landing sites, respectively, were chosen, and I hope that I was able to get across that they were chosen partly because they are really quite different from one another. Oh, they're both in the basalt plain, Bocetus Borealis. But the Lander 2 site is at the edge of the polar mantling deposits, which you will recall are material brought by the wind from all over Mars, mixed very thoroughly together, and then dumped on the surface. Whereas at the Lander 1 site, you don't have anything like the polar mantling deposits. You do indeed have material brought from all over Mars. You've seen the Zilteris, for example, but that's brought in a different way. You know, it's not quite the same sort of thing. And most of that material should be of relatively local origin. Well, the point of all this is that the southern hemisphere of Mars is made of rocks, as I pointed out last week, that are different from those in the northern hemisphere of Mars. You have the higher, lower density, continental rocks, very ancient rocks, in the southern hemisphere of Mars. In the northern hemisphere, you have the same kind of basaltic lava sheets as forms the dark areas on the moon and as form the bottoms of our oceans on the Earth. And you have a similar kind of division on Mercury. You have, throughout the intersolar system, a commonplace division, apparently, and this is trying to tell us something important about the early histories of planets. We're not clever enough yet to figure out what it is, but this is trying to tell us something, that you have this division that basaltic lava is generated by all kinds of different planets, and you also have continental rocks. But the continental rocks have in common only that they are lighter and therefore float higher than the basaltic lavas. They are different on different planets. On Earth, the continental rocks are predominantly a material that is very, very different chemically from basalt. And it is granite, or things that are close to granite, things that are chemically related to granite. On the moon, you do not have granite at all, so far as we can tell. You have a different kind of continental rocks, which are known from the Earth, but are rather rare on the Earth, called anorthosite. And anorthosite is chemically quite similar to basalt. So, it was interesting to find out which of the two was going to be on Mars. You know, was it something like granite, or was it something like anorthosite, or was it maybe something totally different? The origin of granite has long been, for a couple of centuries now, has been one of the big major arguments in geology. In fact, it got really emotional there towards the end of the last century. We know that there are at least two different ways you can form granite on the Earth. One of them is by really, really extending a process that I talked about a little bit last week, and that is the process of gravitational differentiation. That sounds frightening. What all refers to is that in the early histories of the planets, and this is true of the Earth, rather a surprise, it turned out to be true of the Moon, it is also true of Mars, Mercury, and Venus. In the early histories of all of these planets, the entire planet melted. And when it melted, it was made of a mixture of all different kinds of rocks. The light ones floated to the top, the heavy ones fell to the bottom, and then the planet solidified, so you had an onion skin kind of structure with the heaviest materials, for example, the iron and nickel that make up the core of the Earth, down at the very, very bottom, the very lightest materials up at the very, very top, and so on. Well, that process cannot produce granite all by itself. But if you take the rocks that have already been globally differentiated, and then you take additional processes, and differentiate them still further, you can get granite. And you can get granite by simply taking rock and from down under the Earth and melting it. One of the standard kinds of lava on the Earth, of molten rock, is in fact granitic. But another way you can do it is by taking the sedimentary rocks, which are a real rarity in the solar system as a whole, and yet are very common on the Earth. Sedimentary rocks are things like sandstone, for example, and lots of others, shale and limestone and so forth and so on. But sandstone serves as an example. You take a rock and you attack it with liquid water, this weird material that's found in large quantities only on the surface of the Earth, and it's found in such large quantities on the Earth that it dominates our geology. And you make the water break the rock apart, and you let it dissolve some of the minerals that the rock is made of, a thing which would just be unheard of on any other planet. And the ones that survive being dissolved, you transport away by the water. And then you let them pile up someplace in some settling basin. And so you get sand on the bottom of a lake or something like that. And then, later on, when that's not the bottom of the lake anymore because earth movements have pushed it up into the air, you have a pile of sand, and water trickling through it evaporates and deposits cement, which again is something that is peculiar to a planet that has liquid water. You've seen it happen in small quantities on Earth, on Mars, but on Earth, well, on Earth there are places where sedimentary rocks are literally piled up 20 miles deep. And that is something that is absolutely unheard of on any other planet in the solar system. Well, if you take these weird rocks, which are so rare in the solar system as a whole, and yet so common that on Earth, 80% of the rocks on the surface of our planet are sedimentary rocks, if you take a pile of those, take some sandstone, some shale, and some limestone, and so forth, and let Earth movements carry them down several miles underground where it's hot enough for them to melt, and then melt them, lo and behold, what you get, if you then you then melt them and then you let them resolidify and form a rock again, what you get is our old friend granite. Granite is what the continents are made of. And so it's a very important question in geology as to how it originated. A quarter of the surface of the Earth is underlain by this weird stuff, granite, and then you got the basalt underlying the other three quarters, which are the bottoms of the oceans. And there has been this argument about whether granite is predominantly simply a lava, or whether it is formed primarily by the melting and then resolidification of sedimentary rocks. Well, the problem is that both processes are known to happen. So the argument was not, can one happen or can the other happen? The argument was, which one is important? Mars may be telling us the answer. Is there a lot of granite on Mars, or is there not? You see, because on Mars, you've never had oceans, you've never had lakes, you've never even had any bodies of water extending for very long periods of time. Even those great rivers that I told you about last week, you remember I mentioned, lasted only a few thousand years at most. And so you don't expect to find big piles of sedimentary rocks, at least the kind that we have on the Earth, on Mars. So that should be a good clear-cut case. Well, unfortunately, we didn't land in the southern hemisphere of Mars where the continental rocks are. Both of the landings took place in the northern hemisphere on the Great Basalt Plains. And so you'd think we wouldn't be able to know the answer, but we do. We have rocks, especially at the Lander 2 site, which, remember, is in the polar mantling deposit, which are made of, I shouldn't say we have rocks, we have soil, which is weathered from rocks, all over Mars that have been carried there and deposited on the ground. And so if you study this soil at the Lander 2 site, what you are studying is not soil that is simply formed by the breakup of the underlying bedrock, which you already know is basalt. You are forming average Mars soil. You are forming a material that was produced by the weathering of all of the kinds of rock all over Mars. Well, you look at it and you discover that it is indeed the weathering product of basalt, or of a very close chemical relative, even though it should be literally contaminated with continental rocks from the south. The only possible explanation is that those continental rocks from the south are not very different from the basaltic rocks in the north. They certainly are not as different as granite is from the basaltic rocks. And so it looks as though in this respect Mars is like the moon and not like the Earth, that it has divided into two kinds of rocks in its crust, as all the planets, all the other planets have, but that the continental rocks are close chemical relatives of basalt. Maybe they're anorthosite, just the way they are on the moon. Whatever they are, they're close chemical relatives. And whatever they are, you cannot take the southern hemisphere of Mars for granted. It took me 10 minutes just to lead up to that. All right. Now, the remaining interesting finding today from the X-ray fluorescence experiment is the nature of those weathering products. One of them is a particular kind of iron-rich clay called montmorillonite. And I guarantee you've never heard of montmorillonite unless you happen to be a geologist. But it is well known to geologists, and in fact it would be even more well known to them if they were on Mars, because it looks as though monhyrillonite, which is a clay that can be formed by the weathering of basalt, is the commonest mineral on Mars. If it's not the commonest, it's certainly one of the commonest. Well, what's interesting about that is monhyrillonite is a substance which has been shown by laboratory experiments on Earth to be important in the origin of life. Monhyrillonite is a very effective catalyst for one of the major reactions that were necessary for life to originate on this planet. One of the major reactions back when it was all still chemistry and that life hadn't come into existence yet, but the process of chemical evolution was occurring, where you start out with the simple molecules that make up the majority of the universe and slowly build them up and get more and more and more complex molecules made up of them until finally, at the end, you have molecules that are so complex that they are in fact alive. Well, you can take normal early planet atmosphere, the kinds of gases that we think to existed in the early days in the atmosphere of the Earth and Mars and all the other planets, and you can build up amino acids, which are the basic units of which proteins are made. A protein is just a chain of amino acids fastened together, and proteins are the most important of all of the myriad organic chemicals that make up your body, for example. You can build up amino acids by taking a primeval planet atmosphere and doing very simple things to it. For example, exposing it to ultraviolet light, such as we know it got lots of in the early days on the Earth from the sun, or by zapping an electric current through it to simulate the lightning, which surely existed then as well as now, and so forth. But none of those laboratory experiments have been able to get beyond, by doing just something as simple as lightning and a primeval atmosphere, they've not been able to get beyond the amino acid stage. But it has been shown in the laboratory that monhyrillonite is a good catalyst for the formation of proteins from the amino acid units. And so the fact that Mars is lousy with monhyrillonite is still further evidence that if there isn't life there, there certainly ought to be. In other words, that the environment is suitable for life, that Mars has everything going for it, so far as we can tell, to have led to the origin of life, and therefore that if you discover that there is no life on Mars, a thing the Vikings are not capable of showing, by the way, they can prove either there isn't life on Mars, I'm sorry, they can prove either there is life on Mars, or there didn't happen to be life at the places we looked, at the times we looked, that responded to the test that we used. All right. They cannot show that there is no life on Mars. But if you can show that, it's a discovery almost as important as if there is. Because you can't wiggle out of it by saying, oh, well, you don't expect life on Mars. The environment is not suitable. The environment is suitable. And so finding out why you have it on this planet and why you don't have it on that is going to tell you things that you didn't know about the origin of life on this planet. So one way or another, we have already won from the Viking biology experiment, particularly since there are such interesting chemical reactions they do produce, whether they're living or not, but that's for the last two lectures. Okay, here are the magnets on the surface sampler. They're a bullseye. You've got a ring on the outside and then a central dot like so, and one of them is a weak magnet, and the other, I'm sorry, a strong magnet, the other is a weak magnet. By weak, I mean about as strong as a typical dime store magnet, and by strong, I mean about 10 times as strong. And here is a single magnet pair mounted on that color chart that I told you about. This is a black and white picture, so it's not a very impressive rendition of the color chart. But in fact, this is what they photograph every now and again to check the color balance of the camera. And they just cleverly, since they were going to be photographing all the time anyway, the magnetic properties team, which consists of one person, Ronald Hargreaves, who is kind of the forgotten man on Viking, he knew darn well they weren't going to be taking very many pictures just for him, and so he cleverly thought of things they had to photograph anyway all the time to put his magnet on, and that was a good choice for one of them. Well, in fact, I think that our $50 was well spent on Ronald Hargreaves' magnets, because they have come up with a very important finding, namely that both of those magnets do have a good deal of material sticking to them. And you can see that in that picture. It's that black stuff. The magnets are not colored black. They're colorless. So if there weren't things sticking to those magnets, you wouldn't be seeing anything in this picture. It would just look like, it would just look white. Well, the fact that you have magnetic material sticking to both the magnets, even the weak one, very much narrows down the range of possibilities as to what mineral it could be. There are only four possibilities. And you can decide among those four by taking color pictures of the magnets with the things on them. And that has also been done. And so now I can tell you that almost certainly what you are seeing there sticking to those magnets is the same stuff that natural magnets on Earth are made of, and that is magnetite, which is an iron oxide of which lodestones, you know, natural magnets on the Earth, are made. All right, fine. Magnetite is a natural, is an iron oxide, so what? I've already told you there are iron oxides on Mars. But I haven't told you there's magnetite on Mars. Magnetite is not red, it is black. As a matter of fact, if this were a color picture, you'd be able to see that these things are black and that is how they're decided with magnetite. But the iron oxides I've been talking about are the red ones, and those are different oxides. See, you can oxidize iron in stages. If you combine a little oxygen with iron, you get magnetite. If you combine as much oxygen with iron as it is capable of taking, then you get rust. And rust is not magnetic, at least from the point of view of the weak magnet, and of course it's red instead of black, so you can tell them apart. Well, I've shown you that Mars is a planet where, at least in the past, there has been a very severely oxidizing environment, and where, in fact, the entire planet has rusted. And every rock and every soil grain, even the little dust particles up in the air, are coated with iron oxides that have gone all the way to rust. Here you see that there is a lot of material which has not been oxidized all the way to rust. As a matter of fact, it can be calculated from the amount of material that's adhering to those magnets and from knowing, you know, how many times they're stuck in the soil and so on, 3 to 5% of a typical scoop of Martian soil is made of grains of magnetite, which have not been oxidized all the way to rust on a planet where there is oxidation all the way to rust. Now, oxidation is a kind of relative term. It simply means combining with oxygen. And when a lava, for example, when basaltic lava is cooling, there are iron atoms in it and there are oxygen atoms in it, and they do get together and they do combine, and that process alone, without even an atmosphere being present, is enough to give you magnetite. You get magnetite in basalts on the moon as well. Magnetite is a standard mineral that is found in small chunks inside basalt on any planet. And so what I'm telling you is that 3 to 5% of the soil is material from broken up rocks that have been shattered by meteorite impacts and by sandblasting and the dust storms and so forth. Chunks of magnetite from the basalt, which has not yet had a chance to be oxidized all the way to rust. That cannot happen while the lava is just cooling. That requires actual weathering processes. And so on a planet, in other words, it requires, in this case, oxygen and liquid water. And so on a planet where there is a lot of oxidation all the way to rust, we are having the soil generated, recreated, at a fast enough rate that 3 to 5% of it is fresh, unweathered material. In other words, the processes of erosion and deposition are active on the surface of Mars today. And that, I think, is a pretty incredible finding from $50 worth of magnets. Now, here is a clever way to try to detect motion in the Martian landscape. This is a scene at the Lander 1 site, and as a matter of fact, that big VetiFact that I showed you in the first picture was right there, and there's the Volkswagen rock. And then what they did, here's the camera, you know, scanning one vertical line after another, and of course when they reconstruct it back on the ground, the device that reconstructs it produces this line across this strip of the film, and then the next line across the next strip of the film, and so forth and so on. Well, what they did was, at the end of taking that picture, they picked that vertical line right there, and they told the camera to stop turning horizontally, but keep scanning vertically, over and over again, that same line at the edge of the picture. But then, when they reconstructed the picture on the ground, they didn't tell the reconstruction equipment to turn itself off. And so what we've got over there on the right is, here is the first scan that they took of that line, and right next to it, a fraction of a second later, there is the next scan that they took of that line, and right next to that is the next scan and so forth. See what we're getting here? We've got a graph which shows vertical distance across the picture in this direction and time in this direction. Now, suppose a bird went flying across through the scene. What you'd get would be a streak across the picture like that. Right? This is one of the most powerful tools that they have for detecting motion. It's called the single line scan mode of taking pictures, and they routinely do it at the end of taking a picture if they have a little bit of time left. Suppose, for example, that the wind were blowing dust grains around, well then, you'd probably see these little streaks going back and forth in the picture. And so I can tell you with a good deal of confidence that so far no motion has been seen on Mars, with the exception of motions that are known to be due to the spacecraft itself. And that shows that the method is working, not there being any doubt about it. But aside from that, no motions have been seen on Mars, and that is doubly important. First of all, it tells you that there is no obvious biology, or even subtle biology, in the pictures. And you know, that's not a very obvious statement. I mean, you look there, and it certainly doesn't look as though there's anything growing. There's nothing that looks like those bushes that were growing on the sand dunes that I photographed in Death Valley. But if I claimed that that rock right there was actually a turtle, you'd have a lot of trouble disproving it, right? And there could literally, if this were a picture taken in Arizona, any biologist worth his salt could name you hundreds of species of both animals and plants that could be living in that scene and not show up obviously in the picture. And so the single line scan mode is a very efficient way of detecting even subtle motions. If even one of those little dots was an insect, you would be able to see that it was in fact moving. And there has been nothing like that. The other thing is the wind has not been strong enough to blow dust and sand around, and that's not at all surprising. We know that from the meteorology experiment as well. Oh, by the way, let's point out that as long as we're at it, that's a meteorite crater. That's one of the smaller craters on Mars. A couple of inches across. On the Moon, the biggest crater known is 800 miles across. Matter of fact, it can't be much bigger than that. Any bigger than that, it would have blown the Moon apart, the impact when it formed. And the smallest craters were microscopic pits discovered on the surfaces of individual soil grains examined under the microscope, where some little tiny dust grain came barreling down out of space at several miles a second. And of course, there's no air on the Moon to burn it up. And so it slammed into the surface of your soil grain and blasted out this little microscopic pit. And there were craters of every other possible size. Well, on Mars, there is enough air to burn up most of the smaller ones. And so I think it's been very obvious to anybody that has seen pictures of the Moon that while Mars, in many places, certainly not all of them, looks rather like the Moon when photographed from orbit, it certainly does not look like the Moon when photographed from lander scale. There's no way anybody could confuse that scene with a picture taken on the Moon. Anybody knows anything about what pictures taken on the Moon look like? Because on the Moon, this entire picture would be covered with craters. Literally covered, saturated. There is no place you can stand on the Moon and not be inside a crater. The only question is, how big is the crater you're inside? Is it 100 miles across, or is it 3 feet across, or what? Chances are, in fact, you're inside dozens of craters of different sizes. Craters on top of craters on top of craters. You don't have that on Mars. I'd very much like to know exactly how that one managed to form. It must have been something really, really hard that was traveling super fast and was able to come in through the atmosphere before it was entirely evaporated. Here's a picture taken 15 minutes before sunset, a thing the engineers assured us was absolutely impossible. There was no way there could be enough light for the cameras to operate and give a decent color picture. In fact, they didn't want to guarantee that it would be black and white. And that's one of the reasons for something I was telling you about last week, that the scientists tend not to believe the engineers' pronouncements about what can't be done because the engineers are so conservative about it. The engineers who designed the cameras assured us that only around Martian noon would there be enough light for the camera to operate in the color mode. To orient you, there's the Volkswagen rock and there is the washbowl. And this is the top of the foot pad, whose foot pad you saw the bottom of in the very first picture that I showed you. And here's another example of how they use everything on breaking, but this, including the squeal. See that thing there? It's out of focus, but you can see it. It looks like a peppermint candy cane. All right, what that is called a stroke gauge. It's a little rod which is painted with alternate black and white markings so that you can see it even when it is out of focus, because they knew most of the pictures that it would be. which operates exactly like those tire pressure gauges of the sort that stick out the little rod at you, you know, and then you take it off and measure what your pressure was. And it was set up so that at the moment of landing, the hardest shock sent it up to a certain point and then it would stick there. And so afterwards you could photograph it at your leisure, find out exactly how hard the landing had been, and therefore get one more little piece of information about the nature of the Martian soil. And from the length at which it's sticking out, I can tell you that it is a rather firm soil. It certainly isn't hard rock, but it's not anything like soft sand. Of course, we know that now from the pictures anyway, but you can get some quite precise numbers on the bearing strength of the soil, and of course that's important to engineers who want to design later spacecraft. They've got to know how big the footpads have got to be, how hard it is to stand upright, and so on. This thing back there, which is in focus, you're seeing it past the edge of the camera, and that is the cover of the surface sampler head that was held in place by that pin that I was telling you about. It was ejected, as it should have been, but the pin wasn't, and it went shooting off and apparently bounced off a couple of rocks, and they had a lot of trouble finding it. And finally, when they just about given up hope of locating where it was on the Martian surface, there it turned out almost but not quite hidden by this footpad as seen by camera two. There is a crater which they landed right next to. I didn't even realize until they took this picture just before sunset, and the shadows were so long that even a relatively gentle depression would show up. And there, in fact, is another small crater on the surface of a rock. And there's the one that I showed you the picture of before in that last picture. Okay, this is 15 minutes before sunset. Here is a Martian sunset. Isn't that great? And I think of all the pictures that I've shown you so far, this one is the most alien. There's nobody who would think for a minute that picture was taken on Earth. Whereas the landscape pictures, you could believe that very easily. I've got to warn you, some of what you're seeing, of course, is not real. Obviously, the stripes in the sky are not real. That's the way the computer reconstructs the picture. And those are useful. The computer can only see certain tones. In other words, if you have a continuous gradation of brightness, what it does is show all of it a certain brightness until it gets down to the next step that it's able to show, and then suddenly goes to that step and so forth. What that means is these lines are contour lines of constant brightness. They're what we call isotopes. And you can learn all kinds of things about a light source by studying its isotopes. So it's really great that our computer is that primitive and draws isotopes for us automatically. The other thing I have to point out is that these bright dots that you're seeing in various places are not real. Particularly, these are not stars up there. They have not been able to see any stars so far through the dust in the Martian air. And a big disappointment to me, they've not been able to photograph the Earth. And they tried several times, but you cannot see the Earth through the dust, which is kind of a shame. Now, that's in the summer, and this is in the summer. That sunset, that beautiful glow that you're seeing, and all those beautiful colors are quite correct, and the gradation in the colors from one side to the other is quite correct. And you can see the sunset is rather bluish. It's exactly the opposite of our situation on Earth. On Earth, we have red sunsets and an otherwise blue sky. On Mars, you've got a blue sunset and an otherwise red sky. And that's kind of an interesting reversal. The sun, at the moment the camera scanned past it, was right there, and that was 20 minutes after sunset. I began taking the picture 4 minutes after sunset. This is 120 degrees of horizon that you're seeing it. It's quite a wide angle view, and I should have it wrapped one third of the way around you if you were seeing it in the right scale. And of course, the reason for that beautiful glow is that the dust in the air is reflecting the light of the sun up from below the horizon, and it's lighting up the air even though it has already set for an observer on the ground, and so you see this beautiful effect in the sky. Well, as a result of that, this is, as I say, a summer sunset, and there's a lot of dust in the air in summer. There is much less dust in the air in winter. We may be able to photograph the Earth come next winter, and I would guess that the sunsets in the winter are going to look quite different from the way they do at this time of year. So summer sunsets, but summer not. It'll be interesting to see how the others look. Okay, let me tell you now about Viking Lander 2 and the saga of the search for its landing site. And here is an example of the reason that saga got started. This depicts a requirement that these dunes, which after all do move around, they're created by the wind and they can be destroyed by the wind, be protected by something which shelters them somewhat from the wind.
That, however, is a statement which I am telling you only now, which we learned the hard way from hindsight. See, that wasn't too well understood at the time they were looking for a landing site over there in Utopia. What was understood was that Mi had in it some very large, obvious sand dunes, and there's no question these are sand dunes even now. And what was understood was that to the west of Mi, for hundreds of miles, there was a region where if you really blew up the pictures, and this is a very highly enlarged and very severely computer processed version of a picture that was taken near what turned out in fact to be the ultimate landing site, what you saw was this funny texture at the very, very limits of visibility. And so the Landing Site Selection Committee's geologists concluded, they knew that this is, after all, the polar mantling deposits, and they concluded that these polar mantling deposits have been blown by the wind into sand dunes. And if those sand dunes were to be visible at all, even barely visible, right at the limit of orbital visibility, such as this picture is, they would have had to be nice big sand dunes, hundreds of feet in size. And that means, since we know things about the shapes of sand dunes, they would have had to be a certain depth, which in fact would be great enough to cover over not only those cracks, but the rocks, which were so common at the Viking Lander 1 site. And the engineers were very, very happy with that, because the Viking Lander is very tolerant of slopes. You say, good grief, you land on the side of a sand dune, you're going to be in big trouble. But you're not. The lander can survive in a 25-degree slope with no trouble whatsoever. In fact, it can even survive the 500-mile-an-hour windstorms while sitting on a 25-degree slope. What the lander is not tolerant to at all is rocks. All the lander has got to do, you saw how short and squat it is, and the reason for that is so it will survive the dust storms, but all the lander has got to do is come down on one rock that's more than 8 inches high, and you have lost the spacecraft. It is very slope tolerant, it is not at all roughness tolerant. And so the engineers were very happy with the idea of being able to land on a field of sand dunes that were so huge that they would bury all the underlying rocks. And furthermore, the geologists, of course, were very happy because it would be a very different kind of place than Viking Lander 1 touchdown. And the press people like me were very happy because we knew that the most spectacular features in the Lander 1 site photographs were what we were still in those days calling the sand dunes. And we were really looking forward to seeing these huge, enormous sand dunes all the way out to the horizon. I was worried about one thing, though, and I asked Hal Mazursky, who was the chairman of the Lander Site Selection Team, if there were going to be any rocks at all for them to study. You know, because after all, you want to be able to see at least some rocks if you're going to do geology. And he said, yeah, don't worry about it. There are craters there, and occasionally a crater will puncture the sand dunes and bring out a few rocks here and there, and the chances are very good that there will be some within the range of the camera. But most of what they expected to find was the sand dunes. Let me show you something else, by the way, which is visible in this picture, and which you may have also noticed in that first picture that I showed you, one with all the polygonal cracks, and that is the weird phenomenon of pedestal craters. Craters which are sitting up on top, each one sitting up on top of its own little circular mesa above the level of the rest of the surrounding ground. Now, obviously, the mesas are associated with the craters and formed after them. It seems a little bit hard to believe that the mesas would have formed first and then that the meteorites would have been smart enough each one to land on the top of one of the mesas and nowhere else. And what apparently happened was the polar mantling deposit has undergone a number of cycles, and so once again we've got evidence for cycles of Martian climate in which first there was deposition of the mantling material, and then the wind eroded it away, and then more material was deposited, and now the wind is in the process of eroding it away again. At least two entire cycles like that. There's some people that look at these pictures and think they're seeing three. What happened was, you have deposition, and the surface is higher than it's going to be after this stuff has been stripped away in the next erosion cycle. A meteorite comes along and forms a crater on that surface. Okay, higher up than the ground is going to be later on. The crater is surrounded by ejecta, stuff thrown out from it. The ejecta blanket forms a protective cap rock on top. And when the erosion then comes along and strips away
the mantling deposit, the stuff under that protective ejecta blanket is protected. And so there is the crater surrounded by its ejecta blanket, left high and dry up on top of its own little special mesa, and the rest of the ground at a lower surface, at a lower level. Okay, so here is a mosaic, a rather hard picture to look at, I admit, because it's been so severely computer processed, but if you look hard, I think you can get it. This is quite a bit of Mars. There's 49 degrees latitude, 48, 47, 45, and so forth, and 1 degree of latitude on Mars is 36 miles. So there is the crater Mi, and that's 50 miles across. So we're seeing quite a bit of Mars, and there, in fact, is the region within which they finally decided. A mosaic, a rather hard picture to look at, I admit, because it's been so severely computer processed, but if you look hard, I think you can get it. This is quite a bit of Mars. There's 49 degrees latitude, 48, 47, 45, and so forth, and 1 degree of latitude on Mars is 36 miles. So there is the crater Mi, and that's 50 miles across. So we're seeing quite a bit of Mars, and there, in fact, is the region within which they finally decided Lander 2 would land, and there is the target, and it did even better than Lander 1. It landed right there. So again, you see these things were really much larger than was necessary, but all they knew before the landing was there was a 50% chance they'd land in that, and a 99% chance that they would land inside that. Well, let's look at the picture, and you can see three different kinds of structure. I'm sure it all looks completely homogeneous to everybody, but let me try to point it out to you. Here is Mi itself, and surrounding Mi, see the radial structure out to about there, not quite that far, and that is the ejecta blanket of Mi. And then, ignoring that ejecta blanket, down here, you've got all the polygonal cracks, and those polygonal cracks disappear right along that line about in through there, and, well, they go up there a bit, but you don't have them up in here. Instead, you have this funny, pimply-looking surface, as though it's got carbuncles, and that is the pedestal craters. And so here's the picture. That is the edge of the polar mantling deposit. The polar mantling deposit has been combed by the wind into these great dune fields, and it is nicely burying the dangerous, cracked terrain and the rock, which you would have even where you don't have the cracks, for example, at the Lander 1 site. So, they landed there, they took the first pictures, and we all look to see the glorious sand dunes, and here is what it looked like. And I'm sure the first thing that impresses you instantaneously is the complete absence of rocks and the beautiful hundreds of feet high sand dunes which stretch from the camera all the way out to the horizon. Well, let me point out, they did land safely. That's the first thing to say. Nevertheless, the engineers had some very acerbic things to say about the geologists on the landing site selection committee. In fact, Hal Mazursky was literally not seen in the press room for 2 weeks after the second landing. We don't know what happened. Obviously, there was a misinterpretation. And I tend to be very sympathetic towards the geologists, because remember, there were unquestionably sand dunes inside Mi. They did know they were at the edge of the polar mantling deposit. They could see the pedestal craters, for example. And, in fact, a major mystery has got to be, and this one is still unsolved, why it is that this region looks so different from the Lander 1 site at orbiter picture scale, where you can see things down to about the size of a football stadium, and yet so very, very similar at Lander scale, where you see individual rocks and so forth. And yes, there are differences, and I'll point a few out, but there's certainly very small differences compared to the similarities. And we don't know that yet. But they, you know, when all they had was the orbiter pictures to go on, they could see it looked very different. They could see them in the polar mantling deposit, and they had this weird texture just barely visible. And they knew there were big sand dunes with a texture that looked sort of like the same thing in Mi. So clearly they're not sand dunes out here, and as I say, now it looks as though most of the sand dune fields on Mars are in fact in enclosed areas, although I will show you a spectacular exception to that statement. But the question is, what that texture was they were seeing in the orbiter pictures, and we don't know. Let me show you some possibilities. First of all, note the sky, and note that it gets darker faster as you go up above the horizon. Apparently, this is a lower area. You're about a mile lower here than you were at the land at one site, and you're also at a different latitude, and I don't know which of those two variables is more important, but the dust is apparently more concentrated at the surface here, and so the sky gets darker faster as you go up above the horizon. Again, you have the phenomenon of a near horizon and then distant objects beyond it, but that near horizon is the one that's two miles away, and those distant things, we don't know what they are. They're a series of ridges, and you can just, I'm sure you can just barely see them from where you're sitting, but the scientists who have had the original pictures to study close up say there are in fact a series of distant ridges. They're in the direction of me, and they may be the outermost ridges of these ejecta blankets, or, you know, somehow associated with me, but we don't know, we just can't see them well enough. You can see lots and lots of rocks. There are, in fact, many more rocks per square foot at this site than there were at the Lander 1 site. They are not as big, however, and so the danger of landing on a big rock is actually somewhat less here. And there are a whole bunch of interesting rocks in this picture, which I'll point out only two. That one seems to have a xenolith in it. These are all lavas, and in fact you can see they're even more highly vesicular for the most part than the ones at the Lander 1 site. But that one seems to have a xenolith in it. A xenolith, see the little dark thing there in the rock right there at the tip of my arm? A xenolith is a piece of a different kind of rock that has a higher melting point than the lava, and therefore is not melted simply by having molten lava around it, which is picked up by the lava as it flows up through the ground. And there you find it, surrounded by the now solidified lava, which had melted around it. And so you can study that xenolith and find out some things about where the lava came from. That could be interesting. The other thing that's kind of neat is this one. Only the people in the foreground are going to be able to see that this edge of it is quite vesicular, and by the time you get over to that edge, it's not. And so there you've got a beautiful little cross-section through a lava flow. Back when that was part of the solid bedrock, instead of being a chunk of individual rock as it is now, this end was up and that end was down, and this was the vertical direction, and there you see the record of that, heaven knows how many millions of years later. Somebody asked me last week, by the way, a very good question, which is, where do all these rocks come from? You know, what is it that produces rocks that is individual chunks on a planet, as opposed to simply solid sheets of bedrock? Because on Earth, that is mostly the expansion and contraction of water with seams as it goes from liquid to frozen and back again in cracks that develop in the rocks for whatever reason, you know, because they're cool, if nothing else. But the point is, it's those that break up the crack, that widen the crack, and eventually turn what was a solid sheet of bedrock into a field of boulders. You're not going to have that on Mars. Well, there are at least two possibilities. One is that they have been thrown out by craters, and nobody would be at all surprised if many, many of these rocks are me ejecta. You don't see the ejecta blanket in the orbiter pictures extending this far, but surely the outermost fringes of it, individual rocks thrown out by the crater, ought to be out here. And the other possibility is, especially since all these are lavas, a very common phenomenon on the surface of a basaltic lava flow particularly is something that is called a-a. It's spelled A-A. It's a Hawaiian word. It means unfriendly. And is a phenomenon in which the lava, here's the lava and it's molten, but it cools and a thin crust develops on the top. You know, it's going to cool first on the top. And then there's still liquid flowing underneath. And so that breaks up the crust into chunks. And then you have all these chunks lying around all over the place. So this could very well be an old flow. The final thing I want to point out in the picture is the final two things. First of all, there's not nearly as much variety among the rocks at the Lander 2 site as there is at the Lander 1 site. There are dark rocks and there are white rocks, and that's about it. And even Alan Binder isn't claiming to find 45 different kinds here. And finally, leaving the best till last, the channel. That's it. And there's another one. And in fact, the whole ground is just crisscrossed by this thing, all around the land. Now, those are not big enough to have shown up at orbiter scale, obviously. It's only a foot or so across. But they do show up at the Lander scale. And we'd very much like to know what they are. Obviously, the most exciting possibility is they're all stream beds. Nobody believes it. For one thing, they seem to form a polygonal network. And so the other possibility is these are our old friends, some sort of polygonal crack. Not the big ones photographed from orbiter. You know, these are far too small to be that, and they're far too close together. But again, we've got a network of polygonal cracks. This one just happens to be a great deal smaller, quite likely unrelated to the big one. But the same possibilities go through, and it may very well be patterned ground And so, once again, it may be evidence for permafrost, or it may be cooling cracks in the lava that is just under the bedrock at this place. In fact, the bedrock is really close to the surface in some places here. It may actually be mud cracks. You know, there is a lot of clay in the Martian surface, and it is clay that absorbs a lot of water and swells up, and then when mud dries, releases that water back into the atmosphere, and that is, and therefore takes up less volume, and that is the reason that mud shrinks when it dries out. We don't know, but it's an interesting possibility. This picture, by the way, was not the first one that was taken by Lander 2. This one is the equivalent of that spectacular panorama with the silt drift that I showed you from Lander 1, and so that was taken several days later. Here is the first picture that was taken from Lander 2, and I want to point out that the same shadowing occurs over there. Notice the rocks do look different. They're very highly vesicular, and you've got these flat chunks. And there's an especially good one, and there's one. And those are very exciting because those imply sedimentary rocks, and those are almost certainly pieces of the Dura crust that I was telling you about. And in fact, if you'd like to see some Dura crust, here is a nice little chunk of Dura crust right over there. And these were some of the rocks that they eventually, no, I'm sorry, these were some of the rocks that they were eventually pushing over to try to get samples from under them later on. The first rock that they pushed successfully was Mr. Badger, which is that one right there. They named some of the rocks for characters in The Wind and the Willows. And so there's Mr. Badger, Mr. Rat, Mr. Mole, and Mr. Toad, and this one is Ickle Rock, which is named for a different reason I won't go into, because we haven't got time for everything. This is the second picture that was taken from Lander 1, and the version as it was first received back on Earth is this one up here, and I think you can see that fuzzy fringe right along the horizon? Those are those ridges that I was telling you about. And I didn't show you the first panorama from Lander 1. This is almost 360 degrees. You're looking almost all the way around the horizon, and so you can see some parts of the spacecraft. This is the housing for the surface sampler. There is the top of the footpad, whose bottom you see in the first picture taken on each lander, and there's the stroke gauge. It landed harder at this site. There is the antenna that is used for direct communication, I'm sorry, for communication with the orbiter, as opposed to the one over here, which is used for direct communication with Earth. They got really shook when they saw that thing, because it looked as though the antenna had been damaged. And then, finally, somebody realized, no, it's simply a clod of dirt sticking to the antenna. This is the cover of one of the two nuclear power sources on the landers. They don't try to use solar power as they do for the orbiters because it's night half the time, you've got the dust storms and so on, and they finally decide to heck with it and they use nuclear. There is the color chart that I told you about, and well, a bunch of other stuff over here that's interesting, but I won't go into it. Well, the first thing that you notice in this picture, obviously, is the depression there, and we kind of wondered if we landed on, you know, in some sort of valley. But very quickly it was realized that, in fact, that horizon is flat. Now remember, this is almost 360 degrees around, okay? So if you were looking at this properly, you should be in the center of a cylinder that goes almost completely around you. And what's actually happening here is the lander is at an 8-degree tilt. And so you see the horizon further down. This is where the camera is pointing up at the sky, and this is where the camera is pointing down at the ground, so you see the horizon further down there than you do here. And one thing that was realized right away after that is that this streak right across there, which they'd also got in the Lander 1 pictures, was not a layer of cloud, because it's not parallel to the horizon. In the Lander 1 picture, there was no tilt, it was parallel to the horizon, but it's parallel to the edge of the frame with some sort of internal reflection in the camera system. On the bottom, you see the same picture in which the computer has been programmed to take out the effect of an 8-degree tilt. And you can see how utterly monotonously flat that horizon is. You are right out in the middle of Cetus Borealis, the great lava sheet, and it is very, very, very flat, broken only by a possible meteorite crater right over there. Well, said the engineers to the site selection committee particularly, how does it happen that we landed in the middle of a perfectly flat plane and the lander is on an 8-degree tilt? And the answer was just what you thought. That footpad is sitting on a rock. Well, it could have been worse. Could have been a lot worse. Suppose the footpad had been sitting on that rock, for example. Of course, we never would have known about it. There's a color picture, which I just put on because it's a beautiful picture. You've already seen essentially all the features in it. To orient you, here is the rock that had the vesicles at one end and not the other, and
down here in the foreground are Mr. Beaver and friends. Badger. Okay, and finally, here is a seismometer on Lander 2, and I can summarize its results very briefly. To date, they have seen one event only, and that was just before Mars went behind the sun last November, which may have been a Mars quake. This is a long-term experiment. It's probably going to take quite a number of years to gather enough data to be really useful. And of course, since we've never seen a Mars quake before, we're not sure we recognize the first one when it comes along. The seismometer does pick up other things. It turns out to be a remarkably good weather instrument. And it records wind chasing spacecraft so well that you can actually get valuable information about the wind from the seismometer. Which is nice, except that the seismometer is supposed to be to detect quakes. And of course, whenever some part moves around, either inside the spacecraft or something like the surface damper moving outside, you pick up the motions. It looks like a quake. It looks more like a quake than anything else. But on the basis of just one, the seismology team is not really willing to say anything, particularly since they've only got the one instrument. See, here's where it would have been so great if the Lander 1 seismometer had been working too. They would have been able to see it on both instruments. Because if, in fact, it is a quake, it looks as though you got the standard signature of a quake on a seismograph, where you have several different kinds of waves which come in sequentially, one after the other. And by looking at the intervals between the arrivals of those waves, you can tell that if, in fact, that is what you're seeing, it was quite a distant quake, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 miles away. And to be detectable at that distance, it must have been a fairly strong one, somewhere around 5 or 6 on the Richter scale. And so you see, Lander 1 would have picked it up as well. Well, we don't have a seismometer on Lander 1. They keep trying. All they've got to do, the reason the seismometer at Lander 1 isn't working, is that all of this delicate equipment, which moves back and forth within the instrument and detects these very, very, very tiny motions of the ground as the sound waves from the quake thousands of miles away go by, you can't land with that stuff banging around in there, or you simply ruin the instrument. And so there is a device which holds it in place. It's called a caging mechanism. And you see there, no, that's something else. Well, never mind. There is a device called a caging mechanism which holds it in place. And then you send up a command after you safely land saying uncage, let go. And the command simply did not get through. The belief is that the reason it didn't get through is that there is a wire which is broken. And all that wire has to do is transmit one signal once and let the seismometer uncage, and then nobody cares about that wire forever. After to the end of the universe, it can do whatever it likes from then on. And so there's always the faint hope that someday, perhaps the thermal expansion and contraction of the spacecraft might get the wire back together again, or maybe some motion of the spacecraft would jar the ends together just long enough to do it. And so regularly, every few days, sort of like somebody keeping a vigil for a lost cause, they send up a command, uncage the seismometer onto Lander 1, and so far it hasn't worked. But this is a point of pride. It's the only failure on Viking. And if they can get that working too, it'll be just so great. The mission director, Cal Broom, told me the last time I talked to him, they're going to try a new set of strategies. They're going to try sending a whole series of commands right through the Martian day, different temperatures. And if that doesn't work, they're going to try sending a command at a time while the antenna, which communicates directly with Earth, is moving. It has to move. It has to be able to track the Earth across the sky in the hope that the vibration will shake those wire ends together just long enough to transmit that one command, and then they'll get it operating. Well, I'll keep you posted on this exciting saga as it goes along. That is not the end of my second lecture. There is much more to say. The projectionist knows how many more slides I've got. However, we are way beyond my allotted time, and I've got to keep some sort of pretense of keeping up the schedule. And so this will give you at least a pretty good idea of what's happened since the two landings. And if, of course, anybody has any questions, I will be more than happy to answer them for you. And otherwise, if you see any time. Yes. Announcements before people leave.
Also a blue GM metal plate, 3D plate chiller. They were last seen on the counter in the bookshop. They may have been next been picked up by someone else. And if someone has seen them, they if we can drop them off at the bookshop again. Thank you.
Okay, let's give people a chance to leave now. Why don't I wait until people leave and then, we can share. There's been some talk about water on one of the planets.
It's been on the radio.
I don't doubt it. I just haven't heard it. There was a thing about water being discovered in a galaxy outside our own for the first time. That's not a planet. That would be interstellar water. Well, water is a very common substance throughout the universe, and I don't know why the news... I don't understand how the news media decide, which science they're going to report and which they don't. I really don't. It's kind of a neat discovery, but I'm sure I could list you 100 other things in the past year about astronomy that are more important than that one and haven't been reported. Water is a very common substance in the universe, not liquid water necessarily, but just water, H2O, whether it's solid, liquid, or gas. Because hydrogen, it's made of hydrogen and oxygen. Hydrogen is the commonest atom in the universe, and oxygen is the third commonest. Second commonest is helium, which doesn't form chemical compounds. And so water is going to be the commonest chemical compound in the universe, and in fact it is. You see it in large quantities in the outer planets, Jupiter, Saturn, and their satellites. You see it in comets. You see it in the clouds of gas and dust in interstellar space, the so-called nebulae, from which stars form. And I'm not at all surprised to have it detected in some other galaxy, and I don't, as I say, I don't really understand why it's news. What it means is that somebody finally developed a radio telescope, or I guess I mean a radio telescope and receiver, which are sensitive enough to have picked up the microwave emissions from, natural microwave emissions from water molecules in interstellar clouds in some other galaxy. But I don't know. All I know is there has been a lot of fuss made about that for some reason. It may be that there is something important hidden about that discovery, which was the reason that the discoverers made a big thing about it to the press, and then the press missed the importance, and reported the aspect of it that didn't matter. That's all I can suggest. But, it wouldn't surprise me if all there was to it was that, and, what happened was some reporter just happened to wake up at that particular moment. Why did they make such a big fuss about Comet Kohoutek and ignore the true comet of the century, Comet Ikea-Seki, which was in 1965, and which really was all the things we hoped Kohoutek might be? It really was visible in broad daylight. It really did have a tail that stretched halfway from the horizon to the zenith. And nobody ever heard of it. And there were a few mentions of it buried on page 47 of the newspaper and all that kind of thing. Why was man's first successful landing on the surface of another planet, which was in Venus, in 1971? Why was that on page 56 of the New York Times? Literally. I don't know. I just don't pretend to understand. So there are two possibilities. One is there's some hidden importance that the reports so far haven't gotten out. If so, I should know it in a couple of weeks when I've had a chance to read things like Science News. And the other, which I think is more probable, is there's nothing terribly much to it. It's just some reporter having to wake up. Yeah.
Okay, now first of all, I'd like to thank you for your Ann Arbor lectures.
Well, you're most welcome.
Attending.
All right. You must be getting bored hearing the same stuff twice then.
Not really.
All right.
Okay, and the question I had was, could you explain what montmorillonite is? I didn't understand the connection it had in helping form amino acids in a protein.
Montmorillonite is an iron-rich clay, but the connection that it has in forming amino acids, in forming proteins from amino acids, is that it acts as a catalyst for those particular reactions. A catalyst is a substance which, by its presence, speeds up a chemical reaction and makes it much easier or makes it go much faster than it would if the catalyst were not there. And very, very often, whether there's a catalyst there or not is what determines whether or not the reaction goes or not. I mean, it speeds it up so many thousands of times that for practical purposes, the reaction just doesn't happen without the catalyst. Your own life could not possibly exist. All of the thousands and thousands of chemical processes that go on inside your body could not possibly occur if it were not for the fact that there's a catalyst for practically every one of them. Because otherwise, the amounts of energy required to get them going would be so big, and the amounts of energy that some of them would liberate once they did get going would be so great that you couldn't afford the first biochemically, and the second would kill you. I'll give you a simple example. You are oxidizing right now the food that you eat. You can take organic substances and set fire to them without a catalyst and burn them,
And you take a lot of energy to do that. You've got to strike a match and produce temperatures of hundreds of degrees, which your body does not have the resources to be able to generate. And it couldn't, you know, if you use up all the energy to do that kind of thing, you'd have nothing left. Unless you, you know, just ate the world in order to generate the energy. And then when it did come out, of course, if it came out as fast as it does when you burn coal, well, it would kill you. Instead, what happens is you do it with catalyst. The catalyst allows the reaction to happen much, much more, with much, much less initial energy to get it started than is required without the catalyst. And also, it allows it to happen very slowly in a controlled way. And so instead of being a temperature of burning coal, it's just at a temperature of 98.6 degrees. The catalysts that are used in biochemistry are called enzymes. And so now you finally found out what an enzyme is. It's not primarily a substance used in detergents. Sir?
How big was the rock that landed
to the... Oh, a couple inches. 3 or 4 inches, I should say. Not all that great.
You said 8 would have destroyed it?
8 would have destroyed it if it had come down so that it was on the bottom of the spacecraft. Of course, if you happen to target so well that a foot pad lands smack on it, you could have survived more than that. As I said, it would take a 25-degree slope without tilting over. But land with a soft underbelly on an 8-inch rock, and you got big trouble. And there was worry. As soon as they realized that they were in an 8-degree slope, which was essentially immediately, there was worry that, you know, if we landed on maybe we landed on the edge of a rock on the foot pad, and the rest of it is sticking up under the spacecraft. Certainly, the rest of it wasn't sticking out where the camera could take a picture of it, you know. And so when they saw that what looked like damage on the high-gain antenna, the engineers were really upset. But it turned out it wasn't that way.
Do you think that they'll be able to see Earth through the atmosphere of Mars?
I ought to repeat these questions so people in the back can hear them. Do I think they'll be able to see Earth through the atmosphere of Mars? Wouldn't surprise me if they could do it in the winter, yeah, in the Martian winter.
When is Mars?
The winter solstice, the first day of winter, is May 30th, Earth date. The autumnal equinox, the first day of autumn, is January 4th. Note that Martian seasons are about twice as long as Earth seasons.
And how will it appear?
A dot of light.
Pardon?
A dot of light. How does the planet appear from Earth?
Would they be able to see it from one of the pictures, or how would they know?
It would appear as one dot of light. You would see it the same way as you see a star, or as you see a planet from Earth. Yeah. How does Earth look from Mars? Well, how does Mars look from Earth? Yeah, it's going to be roughly equivalent. And you would be able to see the moon sitting next to it as another dot. Except there's a big argument about whether the camera is capable of photographing an object as faint as the moon would be, which isn't terribly faint, but the camera isn't all that sensitive to light. The naked eye would have no trouble seeing it at all. I suspect the naked eye could see the Earth even in summer.
But the question is, do you have to take a night picture?
Oh, sure. Yeah, well, we can do that. They're going to photograph the inner moon, Phobos, at night. In the infrared to try to find out what it's made of, which would be a very exciting kind of thing for a whole bunch of reasons that you're never going to know because they don't have time to go into it. Photos was the last part of the lecture here. Yeah?
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, have they photographed either of ours as well?
Not yet, they will.
Only
Oh, you can see it in visible wavelengths. There's just not much point in taking a picture of it from the ground in visible wavelengths because we have so much better pictures taken from orbit. They may end up taking a picture of it from the ground, invisible wavelengths, you know, just for the sake of doing it. I mean, they haven't got much else to do at night.
Also, I want to ask you, does one moon move in one direction while the other goes?
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. And the reason for that is that one of them is the inner one, Phobos, is the only natural moon in the solar system that is so close to its planet that it goes around the planet in a faster time than the planet itself rotates. It goes around in less than one of the planet's own days. There's nothing unnatural about that in the sense that it's impossible. The inner portions of the rings of Saturn, which as you may know are made of millions and millions of little fragments, do that. And there are thousands of Earth satellites, that's artificial Earth satellites, that do that. But Phobos is the only natural moon that we know of that does that. And so the result is that its motion across the sky is determined by its own orbital motion and not by the rotation of the planet, making it just seem to move across the sky the way most of the motion you see of the moon from Earth is. And so the result is that Phobos rise in the west. And well, you can't see it at all if you're north or south of latitude 69 degrees because it's so close to the planet and it always stays directly above the equator. But if you're at the equator where it's going to pass overhead, it'll rise due west
take 2 hours and 20 minutes to travel from the west point of the horizon to directly overhead, during which point it gets noticeably bigger and it goes through a quarter of a cycle of phases. Another 2 hours and 20 minutes later and it's set, and then does the same thing a second time and a portion of a third time during the course of a single Martian day, 24 hours, 39 minutes.
Would you be able to see it moving across the sky?
Yeah, yeah. The hurtling moons of Barsoom is putting it a little strongly. They don't exactly hurtle, but you would be able to watch the motion. Now, Deimos, on the other hand, is almost, not quite, but almost at the synchronous distance. That is the distance where it would go around the planet at exactly the same time as the planet rotates, so it's always directly above a single point on the planet, the way many of our communication satellites have carefully been arranged to be. Deimos is not exactly that, but it is close enough to it that it's just a little bit outside it, and so Mars' rotation wins slightly, and Deimos does rise in the east, and it would appear simply as a dot of light to the eye, whereas Phobos would not. It would show a definite dip. In fact, Phobos, even though it's so tiny, it's only about 15 miles across, it's so close to the planet that when it's at its closest to you, overhead, it would appear about half as big in the sky as our moon does from the Earth. You know, 15 miles across, but it's so close. Well, Deimos would just be a dot of light to the eye, although a pair of binoculars would show some detail on it. And it would rise in the east and then stay continuously above the horizon day and night for 2.5 Mars days and then set and not rise again for another 2.5 Mars days. So, it'd be an interesting sky.
Okay, it seems to be a fairly strong suspicion of permafrost now.
Yes.
And you have an atmosphere that's working at about, what would you say, 1 millibar?
7 millibars.
7.
About 0.5% of the... 7 millibars is the landing site. I guess 5 millibars is a little more... 5 or 6 millibars is more average.
Okay, with some other fellow in Ann Arbor talking about putting communities out in space, what would it take to raise that atmospheric pressure by heating up? You see what I'm getting at?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what would it take?
We don't know because we don't know how much permafrost there is, but estimates are that you might be able to get 3, 4, 5 times as much air as you have now if you evaporated all the permafrost and got into the atmosphere, and that is not anything like enough to breathe. Anyway, it's not oxygen. The whole thing about space colonization in the last few years has been the realization by Jerry O'Neill, who I assume you're talking about, the guy in Ann Arbor who talks about him is me, but Gerard O'Neill, Professor Gerard O'Neill from Princeton University, hit on the realization just a few years ago, more or less by accident, and it's kind of incredible because it's got to be the greatest discovery of the space age, and nobody in all those tens of thousands of people in NASA and the aerospace industry and so on who are paid to do this kind of thing realize this, and here comes O'Neill trying to dream up a kind of neat problem for his freshman physics course, and he hits on this. Namely, that we have essentially now, call it now plus 5 years, the technological capability to build our own artificial world in space. Worlds miles in size, capable of housing tens of thousands of people, even for the first ones, very quickly escalating to millions of people for each, in conditions at least as nice as enjoyed by the most affluent people on the most affluent societies on the Earth, you know, not the Rockefellers, but you and me as compared to somebody in Bangladesh. You can build these so quickly, so many of them so quickly, and they pay for themselves so fast, that you can have, within about a century, or more than a century, more of the human race living in space than is living on the surface of the Earth. And it is quite a staggering concept, and when O'Neill came up with it, you know, he looked through the numbers, and to his amazement, they began coming out right. And after he'd become convinced that, in fact, it really was true, it wasn't something from Buck Rogers from the 25th century, it was right now, he spent 4 years before he finally was able to publish it. And when it finally did get published, the idea just took off like wildfire, and now hundreds of experts in all kinds of areas have looked at it, and nobody's been able to poke a hole in it yet.
But nevertheless,
so you see, nobody's particularly interested in colonizing planets anymore. Why go to Mars, where conditions are so very hostile, when you can build your own world from the ground up and do it the way you want it? Using, by the way, materials available in space. This isn't a matter of robbing the Earth. You build first from lunar materials, and then very quickly from materials from the asteroids, And as a matter of fact, that's the key to the whole scheme, because it's a lot cheaper to get your materials from the moon than it is from the Earth. That sounds startling, but the only reason it's expensive and difficult to go to the moon, the way we've been doing it so far, is that people keep insisting on coming back to the Earth after a couple of weeks. If you stay in space and don't come back to Earth for years and years and years, or maybe even for your entire lifetime, you know, one-way colonization kind of thing, the way it was when the Europeans colonized America. You know, you didn't figure on zipping on back home every 2 weeks. If you do that, it's ridiculously easy to land on the moon and take off because it's so much less gravity. Big, huge Saturn V is required to take off from the Earth. A little bitty lunar module is all you need for the moon. And that turns out to be the key to the whole scheme. It pays for itself within about 10 years by building solar energy collectors in space, which beam the energy back to the Earth, and thereby, just as a sort of incidental warm-up, solve the energy crisis. And then you start moving on to the big ones like pollution and resource depletion and eventually even population. It's quite a thing. And all this is only a few years old. I claim it's the most important political fact of our century. But, you know, whether any of the politicians have heard about it, I don't know. They will. But you see, as a result of that, you know, talking about founding a colony on Mars is, it's sort of like founding a colony in Antarctica on the Earth. You know, we could do it if we had to, but who cares? There's nothing Antarctica has that you can't have better somewhere else on the Earth. You know?
All I was getting at was we would not be able to ignite a greenhouse effect or anything like that.
You would ignite a greenhouse effect, and you would end up with Mars permanently warmer than it is now. However, it wouldn't do you very much good. And I, for one, would very much oppose any scheme of changing Mars that way, or even of sending a manned expedition to Mars, and thereby contaminating it forever and ever with Earth bacteria, until we have had a chance to study very, very thoroughly Mars the way it is. I think the most valuable thing that Mars can do for us is to be just the planet it is so we can learn about planets. And given that we don't need it, given that the way to go in space colonization is to build your own instead of work with the rather imperfect ones that nature has given. That's in fact very imperfect from a point of view of human life. You know, make Mars a national park sort of thing, rather than going down there and building towns, you know, at great expense and difficulty and for no particular reason. Now, of course, there could be things that would change that. Maybe Mars will turn out to have some fantastically valuable mineral that will make it worth exporting. You know, Antarctica has been lucky enough so far not to have had that yet. Anybody discovers uranium in Antarctica in large quantities, it may suddenly keep being a protected continent. Yeah?
Just one question. I caught the tail end. You were talking about people now. Yeah. Are you familiar with the company in Livonia who specializes in
a
space station?
No.
Okay. I'll have to
bring
it out here.
I'd be interested. Okay, but I'd be interested anyway.
This is a real matter, but have you heard anything about UFOs supposedly in
the Lake? No, I lost interest in UFOs so many years ago that I have no idea what you're talking about. So, but if it landed in the lake, I do hope it stays there. Yeah.
There's an article in Time Magazine about one of the orbiters.
Mm-hmm.
Moving closer to one of the moons.
Yes, Phobos. It's going to fly toward the end of February, and they're beginning the maneuvers about now. It's going to fly only 36 miles from Phobos, which is two Phobos diameters away. And that will get not only some absolutely phenomenal pictures, but also it'll fly so close that Phobos' gravity will detectably affect its orbit, and therefore we'll be able to measure the strength of Phobos' gravity, weigh Phobos, and therefore figure out what it's made of. And Phobos is a really interesting thing, and you know, someday maybe Cranbrook will invite me back for a Viking update or something, and I can tell you about Phobos too, because we'll know more about it by fall than we do now. The two things that I've talked about, this and also the bit about photographing and infrared from the surface, will both have been done there. And Phobos, although it's a very tiny world, turns out to be a very interesting one for a whole bunch of reasons. And so really the Vikings are not just studying one world, they're studying three. Mars and Phobos and Deimos. Yeah?
You mentioned last week that the Martian landers had to be sterilized for whatever X number of hours.
Yeah, 37.
What prevented it from being contaminated
Oh, it was, when it was sterilized, it was hermetically sealed into a capsule, which was open only in deep. Sterilized, and only the outer part is dirty. And you don't spring free the BioShield cap, they call it the cap of the face, well, anyway, the other half, until the spacecraft is already in deep space beyond the Earth's atmosphere. Now, I asked once, I guess it was Jim Martin when he was the Viking project manager, whether it was possible for bacteria to migrate from the dirty outside around into the clean inside, and he insisted it was not. However, any doubt that you may have about the sterilization, and you know, there are always people wondering whether it really worked as well as they claim, there is no question it's worked. If the Viking landers had taken Earth bacteria to Mars, we would have clearly detected them by now within the biology instrument, and we have not. So the fact that the biology experiments have failed to give a clear, unambiguous indication of life, if nothing else, at least shows the sterilization worked. So if we do get some life on Mars, you know, if the indications they have given, which are so weird, and you know, might be life and might be and might not be, if it turns out they are life, it is definitely Martian. It is definitely very, very different from anything we've ever seen on Earth. And so that at least is one worry we don't have. And of course, the related worry that the Russians had sterilized their landers well enough and that they had contaminated Mars. Well, if so, the bacteria haven't made it up to the Northern Hemisphere. All three of the Russian landers touched down in the Southern Hemisphere, as it turns out. Yeah?
I wanted to ask you for answers.
Yeah, I did.
Why
did
both
Americans
land? Why
did they end up? I did talk about it quite a bit last week. Can I answer that shortly? Because the Northern Hemisphere is almost completely buried by a sheet of lava that is so dense that it has depressed the ground by 2 miles on the average relative to the Southern Hemisphere. Therefore, you have a denser atmosphere in the Northern Hemisphere, you have a higher air pressure. In fact, the landing sites were chosen to be abnormally low even for the Northern Hemisphere, and we were all the way up to 0.75% of the Earth's sea level atmospheric pressure. That was done for two reasons. First, the parachute needs as much air as it can get to work. Even so, it's quite a parachute. It wouldn't fit into this room, and it is deployed at about the speed of sound and operates for 60 seconds. But that 60 seconds is very crucial. The parachute needs air to work, and the other reason is that if you have enough air pressure, then you can have liquid water, at those places in very, very tiny quantities, because the air is still so dry that any liquid water that comes up to the surface, say when frost melts in the morning, right away evaporates. But for a brief moment, there could be tiny amounts of liquid water, and that might be enough for Martian life. It's not much, but it's all Mars has got to offer in the way of water. Now, let me point it out. All this may be a mistake. Most of Mars is not that way. Most of it doesn't have that much air pressure. Most of it can have liquid water. It is possible that we have really goofed in trying to select those landing sites. We have selected very atypical locations. And it's entirely possible that Martian life avoids those places like the plague. You have to make some assumptions. That seemed like a good assumption. We know that life can exist under Earth conditions. We don't know how far away from Earth conditions you can get and still have it. It seemed reasonable for your first attempt to try the most Earth-like places on Mars. Maybe if this turns out not to detect life, which we don't know yet, we will go to some other place that is more typically Martian. You know, you got to make some assumptions or you can't do anything. Yeah? What happens to the parachutes? They're cut off 14,000 feet altitude, and they go drifting cheerfully away in the Martian winds, and apparently they drift far enough that they're over the horizon by the time the lander lands, because they look hard for them in the pictures.